Dear listeners, Sai Ram, welcome to our radio series, Afternoon Satsang. This is a discussion between Radio Sai's Prem and Arvind on different spiritual topics. Every Thursday on Asia Stream, you can enjoy this live conversation. It's from 12:30 p.m. to 2 p.m. Indian Standard Time. Today's episode was first featured as part of Thursday Live on 30th August 2012.
Sai Ram, and a hearty welcome to our listeners from all around the globe. This is Arvind from Team Radio Sai offering myself at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. The last 3 days in Prashanti Nilayam have been such a beautiful feast, a treat for all the senses, the eyes, the ears, and all the senses. The Onam celebrations are on, and our brothers and sisters from Kerala have come to Prashanti Nilayam in large numbers with excellent programs. And as always, you know, Swami always used to call Kerala as God's own country. And he always seemed to have a soft corner, a special corner in the heart for the people from Kerala. Well, Onam is definitely going to be the subject of this afternoon satsang. And as always, I am joined by dear brother Prem.
Sai Ram Arvind, and Sai Ram to all our listeners tuned in to this week's Thursday Live. And as Arvind mentioned, we are going to be talking about this beautiful festival of Onam. And as it happens every year, the whole of Prashanti Nilayam is flooded with colors of cream, white and gold.
Yes, Prem, those are the colors that represent Kerala. You know, in fact, having been blessed with an opportunity of studying in Kerala for about 4 years, I remember that...
Yes, I think you studied in the Sri Satyasai Vidyapeet, which we had a performance last evening.
Right? Last evening, a dance drama. Exactly, a dance drama by my former alma mater. And I felt very nice seeing that. It took me back to my Srishalam days, you know, nostalgia, you feel so beautiful about it. But this period of 3 days, you know, it is like a grand celebration. The way the world looks up to Olympics, I mean, even that is no match for the way people in Kerala look up to the festival of Onam. You know, there is joy everywhere. There is prosperity, bounty everywhere. You know, there are feasts for the body. There is feast even for the mind, you know, because there are a lot of talks, discussions, debates that go on. There is a feast for the soul too, because there are music concerts, dance performances, you just name it. There are sports activities that is going on. You know, I may not be able to pronounce these words exactly right.
Kerala is most famous for that boat race. Well, I don't know if it's a boat race, but demonstration of that.
It is a boat race, actually. You know, those boats, yeah. They're all long and shaped like snakes.
Snake boats. I think that event is also called Vallankali.
Vallankali. Vallankali. Yeah. And those boats are called Chundan Vallam.
Yeah, and it happens in that very famous called Aran. I don't know.
You know, most of these Malayalam names, they're real tongue twisters.
Definitely. But there's music in that very pronunciation itself.
Exactly. And you know, Malayalam, the word itself, is a palindrome.
A palindrome, yeah.
It reads either way the same word.
And of course, talking of Onam, you cannot skip mentioning about those beautiful floral decorations.
The Pookalam. You know, our brothers, they do it every year in Swami's Mandir at Kulwanth Hall, in the hostel also. They make a beautiful floral decoration on the floor. And it is made up of petals of at least 15 to 20 varieties of flowers. So all the colors are being lent by the different colored petals of flowers. And it's a massive drawing on the floor. Not a drawing. I can say it's a painting on the floor, painted with flower petals and leaves.
And how can we not mention about the beautiful feast which follows?
The magnificent feast. You know, it is served out on a plantain leaf. traditional style. There will be about
less than 15-20 dishes.
15-20 is under, you know, it's on the lower side. At least there will be, on an average, there will be 25 items, dishes. It is a real feast. No,
it's referred to as the Thiruvona Sadhya.
Thiruvona Sadhya.
Thiruvona Sadhya.
The reason that Thiruvona Sadhya, it is held on the second day. Mm-hmm. Because it is believed that it is on this day that King Mahabali visits his subjects in Kerala.
King Mahabali visits his subjects in Kerala, and probably we should tell our listeners the story of King Mahabali.
Exactly.
And without that, the celebration of Onam is not complete.
I mean, that is the basis for the celebration of Onam, and it is also very special for it involves one of the 10 avatars of Lord Vishnu.
In Prashanti Nilayam, Aron Swami, no festival is complete if it is not celebrated with an understanding of the true spirit, right?
Exactly. Every festival that is celebrated, be it Hindu, be it Islamic, be it Christian based, all the festivals, Swami has always emphasized on the underlying spirit. He has emphasized on the spiritual more than the ritual. The ritual is a way to lead to the spiritual.
Absolutely. And that, dear listeners, is going to be our endeavor today in this afternoon satsang. We want to start off by focusing on this festival of Onam and go ahead and learn what are the subtle, important lessons this festival of Onam is trying to teach us. Maybe we should start by narrating to you.
You should, Prem. Maybe you should narrate the story of Onam.
Onam. And the story of Onam is built around one character, King Mahabali. King Mahabali is supposed to be the grandson of Prahlada. Prahlada is the one who brought down the avatar of Narasimha. And Mahabali, being a king in the order of Prahlada, he also happens to be a demonic king.
Actually, Prem, you know, when you mentioned Mahabali and Prahlada, I feel it is so beautiful, the power of the Lord's name. See, Prahlada was born to Hiranyakashipu, who was a demon.
True.
But Prahlada is today worshipped. People name their children after Prahlada, and Prahlada is looked up as an ideal. And though he was born in the clan of the demons, just because he constantly thought of Lord Vishnu, he was single-handedly responsible for the great Narasimha avatar, which descended on earth for the sake of redemption of Prahlada. And in the same line of demons too, we have King Mahabali, the grandson of Prahlada, who, though a demon, is a very righteous king.
And if we can say that the avatar of Narasimha happened to foster the devotion of Prahlada, a similar thing can be said about King Mahabali too. But here the avatar came to correct one small mistake in this devotee of his.
Oh, okay. Okay.
King Mahabali, as you said, as you pointed out, was a very righteous king. And his reign was supposed to be equated to that of Ramraja, because he took care of his subjects very well. He was known for his charity. He gave away a lot of his wealth.
There was security in the kingdom, peace,
and
tranquility.
It was said that he would never turn away somebody who came to his doorstep asking for alms.
Okay.
So this forms the basis of the story of Vamana. Vamana is the first avatar, the Dashavatar, where God comes down in a complete human form.
Okay.
Right? Because till then it is
before
Matsya,
that it was
Kurma,
Matsya, Kurma, Varaha,
as
and
a fish, as an amphibian,
a turtle, then as a wild boar. And finally, Narasimha is half man, half animal.
And Vamana is the first avatar where a complete human form is taken by the Lord.
Hmm.
Okay, and it is said that Bali, Mahabali and his guru, guided by his guru Shukracharya, they were performing a yagnam, that is the Ashwamedha, for the 100th time. Because he had conquered the entire earth and the heavens. That is what the mythological story goes.
Hmm.
So Vamana comes down to actually quell this ego which had arisen in this king, who was otherwise a very, very righteous king. So Vamana comes as a very small, statured Brahmin boy.
A dwarf. Basically.
And that's why Vamana actually means one who is short and one who is small.
Oh, okay.
The actual name of the avatar was actually Upendra. That was the name the Lord adored when he came down in this avatar.
Okay, I did not know this.
Yeah, very Vamana Murthy is actually one who is short.
That's more like an epithet.
Yeah,
rather
more
than
of
the
an
name.
Epithet. So, as this this yajna was going on, Mahabali was giving away a lot of wealth to Brahmins. That is one of the important parts of the rituals. Mm. So here comes Vamana, and very beautifully pictured as a young boy who's short in stature, very charming face, carrying an umbrella in his hand,
mm-hmm.
and dressed up as a typical Brahmin would be. So he comes to the king, And the king and the courtiers and everybody is enamored by the beauty of this little boy. Mm. So when he comes up, the king invites him into the Yajnashala, makes him sit, washes his feet as is the custom, and then says, Lord, you've come, and a Brahmin should always be honored by fulfilling his wish. So what can I offer you? I'm doing this Yajna. And what can I offer you?
So Mahabali asked the great Lord himself as to what does he want.
Yeah, without knowing that it is the Lord himself.
Mm.
And it is said that Vamana asks, you're a king who can grant so much, but I have a very, very small wish to ask from you. And he says, I want land. Okay, so Mahabali says, okay, how many acres and how many thousands of acres do you want? If you want, I'll give you part of my country. He says, no, I don't want that much land. I want as much land as I can measure in 3 paces. You know, 3 feet.
So I take 3 steps.
3 steps. Okay. And you can imagine Vamana is a dwarf. Mm-hmm. And he had tiny feet.
Maybe a 3 feet by 3 feet plot of land.
And it seems Mahabali says that you look like a person who has conquered wisdom. But when you ask, you have showed your childishness.
Okay.
That is what Mahabali says.
In fact, actually, his guru, Mahabali's guru Shukracharya, sees, he is able to see that this is a Lord. And you know, this is another very subtle yet profound point. Because though Shukracharya is the guru for the demons, he is able to recognize the Lord. You know, Swami often says, your mother shows you to the father, father shows you to the guru, guru shows you to God. Here actually Shukracharya points out to Mahabali, tells him that, you know, this is not an ordinary Brahmin dwarf. This is the Supreme Lord. The guru does his role to perfection. And yet Mahabali says, my word once given is a given word and I can't go back.
That is why he is such a great king, because he well knew what was coming after his guru had prompted to him that this is the Lord himself. He knew what it was coming to, but still he said, I have given my word, and as a king it is my dharma to honor the wish of a Brahmin. Okay, so
in fact, Prem, it again takes me on a thought. We often speak of the divine drama that the whole world is. The drama is known and it is just unfolding. You know what actually happens? Another story is there. Shukracharya is not able to convince King Mahabali that this is the Lord and therefore you must not, do not agree to give him what he asks. But Mahabali says, I am going to go and I am going to give this. So when anybody asks, the tradition is when somebody asks a boon, when you grant the boon, you then wash your hand with water, and the water from your hand flows onto the hand of the
person who's receiving,
recipient. The giver's hand is on top, the recipient's hand is on at the bottom. So Mahabali picks up the kamandalu, and at that time, when he's about to pour the water, it is said that Shukracharya becomes, because he's a great guru, he becomes so tiny in size, and he goes and blocks the spout of this kamandalu, so that the water doesn't flow out.
Okay.
And at that time, Mahabali knows what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Shukracharya also knows that this is a divine play.
Mm-hmm.
And Vamana says, O king, are you ready to give? The king says, I am ready, but I don't know what is this. Is this a bad omen?
Okay.
Then Vamana says, this is not any bad omen. He takes a twig and he pokes it into the spout.
Okay.
And Shukracharya, it hits him in the eye. And that is why after that Shukracharya is considered as blind in an eye.
Yeah. Shukracharya is supposed to be
blind in one eye.
Half blind.
That is because of the straw that Vamana puts in and it pokes his eye, and so he clears out and the spout opens up, the water flows in, and that's how Bali decides to give the land that Vamana requested.
Okay, and the important episode comes when he actually promises and then he tells Vamana, now you take your 3 paces, 3 steps and measure the land which you want. And as the Vedic story goes, Vamana reveals his Virata Rupa, that is the Vishwarupa. He takes the form of a very, very gigantic, the cosmic form, so huge that in his first step, he covers the entire world. And in the second step, he covers the entire heavens. The whole sky is covered. And then Vamana asks Mahabali, where do I place my 3rd step?
Okay, because in 2 steps, the whole universe is covered.
Correct. And then at that moment, Mahabali realizes that how fortunate he is that the Lord has come only for him. You know, only to suppress that ego of his, in fact, granted him that Vishwavirat Rupa, darshan of that cosmic form. And so Mahabali bends down, bows and says, please place the 3rd foot on my head.
Again, you know, this is such an important point, because the ego that Mahabali had, it was apparently not affecting anybody in any way, because his kingdom was prosperous, all his subjects were happy. In fact, Onam, is celebrated in honor of King Mahabali. So everybody were happy. Nobody seemed to get affected by the so-called ego. But ego is such a thing that even if nobody is affected, it affects the individual. Mahabali himself, and his ego was huge. And that is why, you know, Mahabali felt that the only thing that is large enough to hold your another step is my ego itself.
Because it is so large.
Yeah. So symbolically, he bent down his head and said, you can place your foot on my head. And that is what Vamana did. And when he put his foot on the head, King Mahabali was pushed down into the underworld.
And talking of pride, you know, Mahabali is said to be a person who's conquered the entire earth. And Lord did not tolerate ego in a person
of that stature.
Then what do we talk about people like us?
We feel proud about our...
Yeah, given all the small achievements that we have, we are given to pride. And it's another beautiful statement which you mentioned before we carry on, that you said that he might not have been a harm to anybody else.
Correct.
He was not a harm to the society, but because he was harming himself, God decided that he has to be corrected. He is so bothered about each individual's progress.
He's concerned with the individual itself.
With the individual, you know.
In fact, you know, one teacher once told me that people often build projects and try to find people for the project. You know, like suppose you build a hospital, then you look forward for recruiting doctors. I mean, you need people for the sake of your projects.
True.
But the teacher said that in Swami's case, it's not like that. For the sake of helping one person to evolve, he's ready to start a project. And if you see many of the massive projects, they've all been triggered off by one person. For instance, if we take one example of the Gram Seva, Swami apparently saw in a newspaper about how one mother, because of dire poverty, having poisoned her children and herself and given up her life, he said, in this land, nobody should go hungry. And he started off a massive Gram Seva project. It was as if the whole project was for the sake of the individual. God always is concerned with the uplift of the individual. And you know, this ego that we are talking about, it gets me a little confused because, see, though it is said that Mahabali had ego and the Lord came to subdue that ego, Onam is in fact, you know, it is the day when Mahabali said to the Lord, he said, Lord, I love my subjects a lot. I would like to see them at least once in a while. So Onam was the day that the Lord granted for Mahabali to come up from his underground home, underground dwelling place, and visit his people and his kingdom. And so, the people deck themselves in the best of clothes, cook the best of food,
it's
decorate their homes.
A welcome ceremony for the Lord who's returning once a year.
You see, if we talk about, say, any other person, you know, who had faults, let's say if you talk about either Duryodhana or whatever, we don't see this happening. One fault is enough to bring your ruin, Swami says. Like Duryodhana, the so-called villain of the entire Mahabharata, he had greed. And for that sake, he brought the destruction of the whole Kaurava family. And at the same time, nobody likes Duryodhana. The same is the case of Ravana, the villain in the Ramayana. He had desire, because of which he kidnapped Lord Rama's wife, and that brought the downfall.
Otherwise he was a great man.
And though people recognize him as a great man, no, because he had that one fault. Nobody worships Ravana today. But I wonder, why is this that, though he means he was so proud and they say he had ego, even today people worship Mahabali. What is this ego act?
Maybe as the program goes, we will try to, in our capacity, unravel what we understand of ego and from what Swami has told, from what we have come to understand in Swami's presence. But before that, I think why don't we listen to this whole story in Swami's own voice?
Oh,
the
wow.
The story of Mahabali. And as always, Swami always gives a little twist in the end, which makes any story, how many times we've heard it, special.
Okay.
So let us listen to Swami narrating this whole Mahabali story and the story of how Onam has come to be.
Kerala Yendu.
In Kerala,
Bali Chakravarti,
Emperor Bali,
Vamana Murtiki,
to Vamana,
Moodadugulu Danam Adigina Chetam Vachindi,
who gave in charity the three footsteps.
Bali Chakravarti ye Goppa Raju.
Bali is a great emperor.
Mahatyagi.
He is the one who sacrificed.
Parama Bhaktudu.
An ardent devotee.
Alanti Parama Bhaktudu Aina Vamana Murti.
Vamana asked for a simple thing from this emperor.
ఈ చిన్న రూపమును ఎందుకు ధరించాడు వామనుడు?
Vamana, why should he come in that war form?
బిచ్చమడిగేటువంటి వాడు చిన్నవాడే కాని పెద్దవాడు కాదు.
The one who asks is small, he cannot be great.
కనుకని బలచక్రవర్తి గొప్ప మహారాజు.
Bali is a mighty emperor.
చక్రవర్తి దగ్గరికి బిచ్చమడుకోవడానికి వచ్చినప్పుడు నారాయణమూర్తి కూడాను చిన్నవాడయ్యాడు.
Narayanamurthy, God himself, came in a small form because he came there to beg.
Lakshmi vahinamu lakshmi endey undanaga anaga pachchi vahana nariki achchi vachamande undaga bichchamettinu yede bilipadega.
Vishnu himself, who has got the bird as the chariot and the goddess of wealth right on his chest, why should he ask for anything?
Kanaka bhagavantudu kudanu చిన్నవాడికి అయినప్పుడే బిచ్చమెత్తుతూ వచ్చాడు.
గాడ్ ఆల్సో హ్యాస్ టేకెన్ ఎ స్మాల్ డ్వార్ఫ్ ఫామ్ బికాజ్ హి వాంటెడ్ టు బే.
ఆ చిన్నవాని పాదములు మరింత చిన్నవి.
అండ్ వాట్ హి ఆస్క్డ్ ఇస్ స్టిల్ స్మాలర్.
మూడు అడుగులు మాత్రమే అయిగాడు.
జస్ట్ హి ఆస్క్డ్ ఫర్ 3 ఫుట్ స్టెప్స్.
కానీ ముల్లోకములంతా సాధించాడు.
బట్ యెట్ హి కుడ్ విన్ ఓవర్ ఆల్ ద 3 వరల్డ్స్.
శుక్రాచార్యుడు చెప్పాడు.
శుక్రాచార్య ప్రిసెప్టర్ సెడ్,
బలి చక్రవర్తి యొక్క గురువు,
హి ఇస్ ది ప్రిసెప్టర్ ఆఫ్ బలి.
బలి ఇతను సామాన్యుడు కాదు.
బలి ఈజ్ నాట్ అన్ ఆర్డినరీ వన్.
సాక్షాత్ నారాయణమూర్తి.
ఈజ్ గాడ్ హింసెల్ఫ్.
నీవు అతనికి మాట ఇవ్వద్దు.
డోంట్ గివ్ ఎ ప్రామిస్.
దానికి బలి చక్రవర్తి చెప్పాడు.
బలి ఆన్సర్డ్ దిస్ వే,
ఇచ్చిన మాటను తప్పను నేను.
ఐ విల్ నెవర్ విత్డ్రా మై ప్రామిస్.
మాట తప్పినేని మరినడు అవుతాడా?
ఇఫ్ ఐ గో బ్యాక్ బై ది ప్రామిస్ గివెన్, కెన్ ఐ బి ఎ కింగ్? నో.
కనుక నేను ఇచ్చాను మాట.
I give the promise.
ఏమైనా సరియే నేను తప్పకిస్తానన్నాడు.
కమ్ వాట్ మే, ఐ విల్ ఫుల్ఫిల్ మై ప్రామిస్.
కనుక భగవంతుని యొక్క వాక్యమునకు అడ్డు తిరిగేటువంటి వ్యక్తిని చాలా తక్కువ.
ఇన్ ఫ్యాక్ట్ దేర్ వర్ వెరీ ఫ్యూ ఆర్ నన్ హూ వుడ్ ట్రాన్సెండ్ డిసోబే గాడ్స్ అటరెన్సెస్.
వామనుడు అడిగినట్టుగా ఇచ్చాడు మూడు అడుగులు.
ఎంపరర్ బలి గేవ్ 3 ఫుట్ స్టెప్స్ ఇన్ రెస్పాన్స్ టు ద రిక్వెస్ట్ ఆఫ్ వామన.
ఒక్క అడుగు భూలోకం అంతా అయిపోయింది.
విత్ వన్ ఫుట్ స్టెప్ హి ఆక్యుపైడ్ ద హోల్
భూర్భువస్వః.
భూర్భువస్వః,
ఈ మెటీరియల్ లోకం అంతా కూడాను ఒక్క పాదములకు చేరిపోయింది.
ది ఎంటైర్ మెటీరియల్ వరల్డ్ ఈజ్ ఆక్యుపైడ్ బై జస్ట్ వన్ ఫుట్ స్టెప్.
స్వః
స్వః
భూర్భువస్వః.
భూర్భువస్వః,
భూమం అనగా భావముతో కూడినటువంటి ఒక లోకము.
ద భూవర్ రిఫర్స్ టు ద రెల్మ్ ఆఫ్
అదే మైండ్
That's the mind.
Suvarlokamu.
Suvarloka.
Adi atmatattvamu.
That is the nature of the self.
Kanukane material lokamu.
One the material
world. Bhavalokamu.
The realm of thought.
Atmalokamu.
And that is the self.
Moodu cheri okkate.
The matter, the thought and atma are one.
Arvind, I mean it's really profound. It will take a long time to think in that message that Swami was saying. Those three steps were so significant.
Exactly.
Bhur, Bhuva and Suvaha.
In our scriptures, the way it is said, it's all said in a camouflaged manner. But the way we hear the story, it is that he covered the earth, he covered the skies, and the third was on the head. But the way Swami puts it, Bhur, Bhuva, Suvaha, it's awesome.
And it is clear that many of these stories are cryptic for a reason. It is meant for those who are ready to inquire.
Exactly. So the first step is getting over the body. The next was the mind. The final step, you know, Atmanivedanam. So beautiful.
And that is why I think it is more important to look at this concept of ego in a little broader perspective. Because Swami is saying, you know, when you say bhu, that is the worldly possessions. One kind of ego which comes out of those worldly possessions, you know, that is the feeling of pride. I have achieved this and I possess this and I am this. So that which comes out of worldly attachments is that ego, that is, which is pride. But what Swami is telling about the mental level, of course, mental level again is that identification of yourself with this body.
With the skills, with the talents.
With the skills and the talents. But the third one which Swami says, that which is the, you know, the flaw in the understanding of what you really are.
You know, that is what even in the Christianity, if you see, they say, cut your ego, cut the small eye across the cross. You know, Swami gives the example that you take the eye. The eye is your concept of what you are. We often do not realize. Swami says there is only one. I am God, but you are also God, you don't know it. So Swami says that wrong sense of I, you cross, you cut it, and that is what you get the Christian cross.
So it's very clear that, you know, ego is, pride as ego is just very, very small
one aspect,
one aspect of ego.
Correct.
So truly ego is
wrong identification.
False identification of what we are. And maybe that is what in the story of Vamana and Mahabali is come to depict. In one step, what he possessed through his physical abilities was given to the Lord. And the other step, he probably realized what, who he was dealing with. When with one step he could cover the whole heavens.
Exactly.
He is giving his achievements even in the mental level. And then the third step is that final, you know, culmination where the oneness is reached.
You made that point, Prem, about a wrong identification. I feel this is so beautiful because theoretically we have studied, you know, ego means body attachment or body identification or wrong identification. However, when we, you know, maybe it's because of the language, the usage, when we say egoistic, we wrongly take it to be pride. But the way we see it now, it brings so much insight, because anything that we wrongly identify ourselves with is ego. So not only is boasting can be considered egoistic, even when we condemn ourselves, it is egoistic, because even when we condemn, we are identifying ourselves with this body or the frame that we have got and not identifying with the divine.
And so, we are kind of isolating ourselves from that whole. You know, whether it is pride or inferiority, we are kind of saying that, you know, the mind plays on you to either make you feel that you are special in a greater way or special
in a negative
way.
Through either of that, it tries to isolate you from the wholesome or the totality that actually we all are. You know, speaking of isolating from the totality, I was reminded, you know, I had attended one of Professor G.V.'s talks.
Okay.
And in that, somebody at the end of the talk asked a doubt. She got up and asked, Professor, how do I know whether I'm enjoying solitude or whether I'm suffering loneliness? Because both of them are somewhat, you know, concerned with isolation, right?
Loneliness and solitude.
Solitude. In both you are alone, but one, loneliness is negative and solitude is often, you know, it's eulogized in poems and songs everywhere. Even as she asked this question, I was going on thinking of what might be a probable answer for this. What is the difference between solitude and loneliness? So I was thinking, you know, loneliness, yeah, it is negative. It makes you feel alone. But solitude, yeah, you are alone, but it makes you feel great about being alone. You see, I was differentiating based on the, can I say, the symptoms of loneliness and solitude. And Professor G.V., G. Venkatraman sir, yeah, we lovingly call him Professor G.V. So the answer that he gave, it came instantly, and I feel it was like hitting the nail right on its head.
Yeah,
he said,
quite eager to know what was that answer.
I know, I'm just building up for that suspense, you know, because it feels greater to deliver. He said, when you have body attachment, it becomes loneliness. When you have attachment to the soul, that is Atmabhimanam, it becomes solitude. He further elaborated. He said, when you have Dehabhimanam, or body attachment, you feel you are separate from everybody. As you said, you know, the mind makes us feel we are isolated from everyone else. And that's why when you feel you are isolated from everyone else, when nobody else is there, you feel really isolated. And that is what is loneliness. But if you have Atmabhimanam, you are not feeling isolated. You feel that you are a part of the whole. So since you are part of the whole, you can never be separate from others. So when you have Atmabhimanam, there is no question of you being with others or being alone, because you are, that's all. There is no others. Whether there are 100 bodies around you or no body around you, nobody around you, you are still wholesome and complete, and that is solitude. So the difference between loneliness and solitude is the difference between Dehabhimanam and Atmabhimanam.
It's just that when you feel that you're alone and you're not complete, and
that is
you're
loneliness.
Alone, and you feel that you are complete always. You've been very, very profound, and I don't think I would have ever thought of an answer like that. Beautiful answer. That apart, I mean, now we have come to a state of how to, can I say, de-identify ourselves with what we've believed ourselves to be. But practically, how is that possible? How do you think that, you know, what kind of a practical implication it will have on our lives if we were to really seep in that message.
You know, Prem, like everything begins with an axiom. When I used to think of this, I used to begin with the axiom that whatever Swami says is right. Mm-hmm. And we go on. Okay. Mm-hmm. So Swami says, you are all one because all of you are sparks of divinity. We are all like sparks of the single flame, droplets of the ocean, which means we are all divine.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to, you know, experience this being oneness, being whole with everyone and not as an isolated people, I used to feel that if we have to do that, we should be able to see divinity in everyone.
True.
Because I see Swami in you, I see Swami in animal on the road, I see Swami in the flower seller. I should see Swami in everyone, and that is why I'll be able to treat a person uniformly.
You mean, I treat everyone as Swami. Fix that factor that Swami is in everybody, and then accordingly solve the rest of the, rest of the problem.
So I treat everybody as Swami.
Okay.
But again, you know, here another question came. What do I mean by treat everybody as Swami? I know how I treat Swami. Suppose Swami comes and sits in front of me. I'm going to go do Pada Seva, sit with my hands folded and full attention on him. I mean, does it mean I do the same thing for, say, the maid servant who comes home? Or say the auto driver who takes me from one place to another?
Mm-hmm.
Or say to a dog lying on the road? Do I go and touch its feet, worship it, put flowers? What does it mean actually to see Swami in all? And for this, I came across an analogy.
Okay.
It was so profound and beautiful, and it's not something very new. The analogy states that the whole world is a stage, and all are actors playing out a drama. This is not new because, you know, even Shakespeare has said it.
Correct. All the world's a stage.
And we men and women are merely players.
Actors.
Actors. So, when we take it like that, just imagine a play, a drama. So you have a hero, you have a villain.
Mm-hmm.
The villain is supposed to embody all the negative and the hero embodies all the positive. So towards the end of every drama, because all's well that ends well, the hero vanquishes the villain. So suppose the hero is killing the villain dies. Now I was thinking, in the drama, when you see the actor's face, the hero has anger. He shows anger on his face. He shows irritation on his face. He wants to finish off the villain because the villain has done bad. But immediately after that scene is over, you see the hero and villain sitting next to each other, sipping at a cup of coffee and talking with each other. They are absolutely friendly. Why go till after the scene gets over? Even in the scene, though the hero is showing anger against the villain and though the villain is showing cruelty towards the hero, in their hearts, they have no animosity. In their hearts, they have only love. I mean, they know that we both are simply actors. It's just that I have donned this role, he has donned that role. And he's doing his role, I'm doing my role. So I'm supposed to show anger because that's a script. I'm the hero, I'm supposed to defeat him, I'm supposed to kill him. So I shall kill him. But I shall not hold any grudge, hatred, irritation or anger in my heart because I know it's just a play. So I feel that is the way we can go about in day-to-day life. When I'm treating my maid servant, it's not that I make her sit on a throne and worship her feet. If she doesn't do her job properly, I scold her. But when I scold her, I should not have irritation in my heart. I should not have anger in my heart. It should just be a facade. It should be only on my face. And the same with love also. When I love my child, I love it because I know this child is part of the drama, playing the role as a child and me playing the role of a parent. But in my heart, I should not get attached. Because in the drama, for example, if the hero gets attached to his son, let us say, in the next scene or in the next drama, the son may be acting as a beggar boy on the road. It would be very funny if this actor comes and starts crying, telling, you know, my son is a beggar. So we don't know. So neither should we feel irritation, hatred, nor should we feel attachment. And same time carry out our duties.
Keeping that understanding that this is a play and we are just playing a particular character in it. And each one around us is playing a particular character. That knowledge is so important.
Exactly. See, it's not that I'm doing this. Okay. This is only theoretical. But somehow it happens that theoretically when you get satisfied, you know, you find more reason to try to practice it.
True.
So now, suppose my boss does something wrong to me. It tells that as per the rule, If I'm supposed to write a letter to my boss saying that I'm unhappy with that, that's part of my duty, I should do it. But when I write that, in my heart I'm not supposed to feel anger and irritation to my boss. In the same way, if my junior doesn't do a job properly, I'm supposed to scold the junior and get him back onto track. I should scold him only because he's back onto track. There should be no irritation or hatred in my heart.
In fact, that is what even Swami used to say. Whenever Swami used to express anger, Swami always used to say that, I never get angry.
Exactly.
I pretend to be angry so that you will be corrected.
And you know what, Prem? With Swami, you would have experienced it. I'm sure all our listeners, everyone would have experienced this. You know, they tell that Swami is putting me through the cold treatment or the hot treatment, whatever. But the minute you realize what is the message that you are supposed to learn, the minute you learn, Swami is back to you as if he is your best friend for life. And that he is. And that is why he is able to do it. Means though for 2 years or 3 years he may be scolding you, he may be telling this is wrong, he may appear angry on you, upset with you. The minute you realize it and change yourself, everything is gone.
And in fact, Swami is such a perfect actor that forget the treatment changing to one individual. When Swami is angry with one person, at that very same instance, Swami can turn and look at another person and smile as though there's nothing. That doesn't happen with us.
Exactly.
Because when we are angry, the whole frame shakes. And you know, we are boiling and we kind of pour it on everybody who comes,
you know,
in that situation.
That's why they say, you know, don't try to take a decision or make a judgment when you're angry. Because if today I'm upset with somebody, anybody who comes in my path had it. Other thing holds good also. You know, they often tell, you know, this is a time when he's had his food and he'll be happy, he'll be in a happy mood. Because, you know, when you're playing, when you're in a happy mood, that's why they say don't make a promise when you're happy. Because when we are happy, we seem to be lenient and that happiness rubs on over to others. That is because we are so involved in our emotions.
As you say these things, it is like the more you become spiritual or the more you want to become spiritual, you should become a better actor in life.
Better actor, and do not allow the emotions to overtake you. In fact, I remember, Prem, you know, when we were doing a convocation drama, we had some actors who were not able to do their roles properly.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going on, you know, being as part of the directorial team, we were trying to tell them that you have to, you know, go into the shoes of your characters, become one with them. And that is what even I used to do, for example. So if a tragedy is happening to my character, I go so deep into the role that I feel almost the tragedy is happening to me. And believe me, Prem, every time I used to act, when that scene came, I used to get tears in my eyes because it used to be as if I am going through it. And at that time, one of the actors got up and he raised a point which irritated me at that time. It is very, very significant. He said, why do we have to go through this pain of the characters every time we act? We are actors. We should be able to produce tears when it's needed. We should be able to produce a smile when it's needed. Why should I go through the pain? What, the way you're teaching acting is bad. We should not go through this. And he was a very good actor and he could do anything that he wanted. So it actually at that time led to an argument where I said that you are a good actor, you can do it, but forget it. But now when we look back to it, that is what we are supposed to do in life. We often think that acting out life means getting so involved in it that we undergo the joys and sorrows. No, we are supposed to not get affected, we are supposed to be good actors.
It comes to the point where you say that selflessness, you know, whether it is anger or whether whatever your act is, that selflessness is what makes it more pure. And just talking of this point, I'm reminded of one discourse which I heard long back, Arvind. It was delivered by Swami in the auditorium, you know, for the boys. And the way Swami began, very dramatic, you know, sounded really dramatic. And even now I can recollect that. And Swami started his discourse like this, you know. He said, people say that anger is bad.
Okay.
I say anger is good.
Oh.
And then Swami said, people say that compassion is good. I say compassion is bad.
Wow. Okay.
And then Swami went on to explain so beautifully. Swami said, anger, selfless anger is always for good. And Swami said, Durvasa is one who had selfless anger. The Maharishi Durvasa was renowned for his temper. Swami said, sage Durvasa's anger always led to mangalam, always auspiciousness, because his anger was selfless. And Swami again said, a mother's anger always results in goodness.
For the child.
And similarly, Swami said, misplaced compassion is always bad.
Can lead to laziness.
Can lead to, you know, spoiling the person. on whom the compassion is showered. So it's very clear that whether it is anger or whether it's any emotion, to be detached from that emotion, to express that emotion as the need of that hour.
I think if we involve ourselves in the emotion, that is ego.
True.
Because we are not the emotion. We get a false identity that we are the emotion. And that is why when we are angry on somebody, that anger rubs on to everybody else, because we feel that is what is us. It is not like a cloth that we have to wear. It's, you know, we should use our emotions like when we are doing a surgical operation or when we are doing some chemical mixing, we wear gloves. After that job is done, we discard the gloves. Because next, if you have to go and cook food, you wear on something else. So I feel just as we use different gloves and discard them as and when necessary, our emotions too should be like that, something that we put on and not something that defines what we are.
And most often what happens is, as you said, do not make decisions when you're angry. What happens in our life is we make decisions when we're angry, and a lot of energy and time is spent in trying to hold on to those decisions. It's again because of attachment. You know, we are attached to that emotion of anger, and we are attached to the decision which is taken in that anger.
And it comes back to ego, because I think the best possible definition of ego is anything that isolates us from the whole that exists. Because Swami says there is only one, that is God. Anything that contributes to us feeling otherwise is ego, because ego is defined as false identification.
And this would be a very good touchstone. You know, every thought which comes, is it making me feel like I'm a separate entity?
Correct.
Is it making me feel separate from the people around? It's much easier said than done.
It's much easier said than done, but Prem, that is how our whole universe is built up. See, for example, if you see the structure, see, we have about 235 to 240 elements. These elements constitute everything that we see in the material universe. But all these elements, if you break them down to their smallest, they are nothing but electrons, protons and neutrons.
Correct.
So there is a unity. Actually, all the elements are one. It is just that, you know, the way it manifests is different. You come up to the level of the human body. You know, every cell if you take, it has the same organelles. You know, just as body has organs, a cell is having small organelles. And whether it's the ribosomes, the mitochondria, the Golgi body apparatus, there are different structures in the cell. It is the same in every cell. But as we go higher, the cells differentiate, they form different tissues, and we have different tissues coming from together organs, to form organs, different organs coming together
organ
to form
systems,
organ systems.
Organisms.
So finally, you feel that the leg or the nail is different from your brain cell. But actually, though they are same,
break it down, it's again the same atoms and same electrons.
Exactly. So they can't function haywire. You know, yesterday you were telling me about sickle cell anemia.
Yeah,
I think you should share
very,
that.
Very, very fascinating thing, you know. Somebody had mentioned to me earlier, the cause of sickle cell anemia, we can't imagine. I mean, you can say that, you know, if there's something goes wrong with an organ in my body, it has a certain size, you know. You can relate to if an organ is leading to some malfunction of the body.
Exactly. Your kidney stop functioning, you have a problem.
Yeah.
Your heart function.
Something like sickle cell anemia, it is fatal in some cases. It's a kind of cancer. And you know what causes this cancer? It's really mind-boggling. How small that cause is. You know, the hemoglobin, which is the important component in the blood. Okay. If you look at that, it is actually made of four polypeptide chains.
Correct, four chains.
And overall, there are about 574 amino acids. Okay, it's made
574
of
building blocks.
574 amino acids. And in one part, you know, to be precise, it happens in one particular gene which is called HBB. In the medical terminology, it's referred to as HBB. In that, in one position, in the sixth position, the amino acid glutamic acid is replaced by valine.
And a person suffers from sickle cell anemia.
And he can die of it.
It's almost like telling that you change one grain of sand in the brick that is making the home, and the home collapses.
But this is just one example. There's so many such diseases which are caused by one gene, you know, one cell going haywire.
You know, Prem, this being together, this part where one small thing affects the whole system, that is increasingly being recognized by science, whether it's interconnectedness or, you know, for example, the chaos theory says that a butterfly flapping its wings in, say, some faraway Mexico can cause a tornado in Australia. Because it says everything is interconnected, and the way it happens, because we are seeing the final two results. You see the initial, the butterfly flapping wing, and you see a tornado in Australia. It seems totally disconnected. But just
that we have not established that connection, you know.
Exactly, but it is as disconnected or as connected as, say, the cell in our toenail and the cell in the brain, or uranium and hydrogen.
Just historically looking back, imagine a few centuries ago, when somebody had told the face of the moon has an effect on the tides.
Exactly.
You know, but today we know it is true that with the change that happens in the sky, we have changes in the tidal waves.
Exactly.
But maybe similarly, the butterfly flapping its wings, we have not established that connection between what happens, you know, with one event to another. But I think science is progressively coming to that understanding that everything is interrelated.
And Prem, we can see it. We can see that kind of evolution happening. For example, who would have thought that one bank collapsing somewhere in one corner of the globe can affect the economies of countries across the globe? That interconnectedness seemed to be there. It's almost as if, just as all the elements are commonly interconnected through their electrons and protons, just as though we have so many different kinds of cells, each cell is part of the organism called the human body, maybe each of us living beings are part of one cosmic being.
So I think scientifically, socially, we are all coming to that understanding that we all are interconnected. But as we said, you know, to bring it in every action of us, every thought of us, that is what is the effort which will be required.
Exactly, and that is what Swami says, you know, in the Vedas it is said, Sahasra Shirisha Purushaha Sahasraksha Sahasrapath. Swami says that when the Vedas say that the cosmic person has 1000 head and 1000 hands, it is not some museum piece. Swami says that during the times when the Vedas were propagated, society had only about 1000 people. And so, in order to say that everybody is divine, it was said that the cosmic person has 1000 heads. And in one discourse, I remember Swami said, today if we have to chant that, it has to go to crores. Mukkoti Swarupudu. We should tell that he is the embodiment of 3 crore forms. Because everything is divine. It is high time we realize this interconnectedness, and we feel that we are all part of that cosmic being. So there's no difference. You might be the brain cell. I might be the cell in the lung. But we both are connected through the cosmic being. And anything that happens to me affects you. Anything that happens to you affects me. Now see, it becomes so beautiful, because anything happening to you is as good as it happening to me. So I'll be concerned for you. Automatically love comes, automatically compassion comes.
There's one very famous Christian story which goes, in a village, there is some kind of an unrest which is happening, fight over some issue, and people are beating each other up. So there is this priest in that community who wants to bring some sense into these people. And it so happens that he's walking in the woods one day, and a woodcutter is chopping wood, and accidentally the axe slips from his hand and cuts his own left hand. It's a huge cut.
Okay.
So that is when this priest walks in into the scene, and this man is tying a cloth around that wound. So this priest asks him what happened. So he explains, this is what happened. So he says, you mean to say that your right hand cut your left hand?
Okay.
Then he said, what you should be doing is taking the axe with your left hand and chopping off your right hand, because the right hand has cut your left hand.
Correct. Okay.
He says, what a foolish suggestion are you giving? It is my hand. Okay, and then the priest goes on to say, don't you see the society also is a similar thing?
Beautiful point, Prem. This is a beautiful point, because we see that happening. Somebody says that you have done this, you have bombed us, so we'll bomb you back. You have hurt us, we'll hurt you back. When we see riots between two communities, between two religions, between two different nations, it all comes down to the right hand chopping the left hand, because the left hand chopped the right hand.
I would like to come back to that point where Swami said selfless anger is good. You know, the anger of a mother is always for good. There's a lot of wisdom in those words.
Exactly. But Prem, before we go ahead, I think we should take a small break here. And I have selected one song which is very, very close to Swami's heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel that song is very close to our topic, because the song is in Telugu. And once our listeners hear it, I'm sure they'll know which song I'm referring to. I will not reveal that. But that song says, what is the use of the eyes which cannot see the Lord? What is the use of the hands that do not serve the Lord? What is the use of the mouth that does not proclaim about the Lord? Because the Lord alone is in the universe. There's nothing else other than the Lord. Everything is the Lord. So we are talking about ego. How ego is false identification. And to give up this false identification, we have to be able to see God in everyone, everything. And therefore, we should celebrate with our eyes. When Swami says, what is the use of eyes which does not see God? It does not mean that, what is the use of an eye?
Stop seeing what you see.
Yeah, it doesn't mean you stop browsing the internet or anything. But wherever you see, you should be able to see God. I feel we should play that beautiful song here.
In this changed understanding of...
Exactly. Whatever we hear, we should know that it is the sound of the Lord. And that will change what we feel. Because it all boils down to what we feel.
Very beautiful, Arvind. So let's play this lovely song for all the listeners.
నించని దేహమేలను నిన్నే పూజించలేని కరములే చూడని కన్నులేలను కను వెందుగా నేను చూడని కన్నులేలను నిన్నే మరచి నింతలంచని జన్మమేలను నిను తలవని నిను పిలవని జీవమేల దివ్వమేల నిను తలవని నిను పిలవని జీవమేల దివ్వమేల మధుర మోహన ధర శ్యామ సుందర స్వామి ఆనంద ప్రదాయి మాందాలా
యు నో ప్రేమ్, వెన్ వీ వర్ కిడ్స్ అండ్ వీ వర్ లర్నింగ్ మ్యాథమెటిక్స్, I remember the teacher putting down some principles. She put down one of the principles as, if A plus B is equal to C plus D, then C plus D is equal to A plus B. So I thought, what is so great about this principle? I mean, why are you teaching this?
It's
known.
Obvious.
It's so obvious. Listening to this song, you know, in this song, I remember every time we sang this song, sat in front of Swami, I remember in Delhi, the day we had to leave and return back to Puttaparthi, we were all feeling, oh God, Swami, this trip has come to an end. Why do beautiful things have to come to an end? And we sang out this song. As we were singing this song, we got tears in our eyes, okay? Because the song, it comes, Swami, you are our mother, you are our father, you are our friend, you are our guru. And we were shedding tears. Swami also began to shed tears. It was such a beautiful moment. I mean, but now when we look at it, when we look at that mathematical principle of if A plus B equal to C plus D, then C plus D equal to A plus B. If we say, Swami, you are our mother, you are our father, you are our friend, you are our guru. That means our friend, our guru, our mother, our father is Swami. I mean, if we tell Swami, our eyes see you, our ears hear you, seek you. The reverse automatically holds true.
All that I see and all that I hear. And
is you.
What I feel.
I mean, the song carries such a profound message.
And that last paragraph where it says that if I don't forget myself and lose myself in you,
what is the use of this life? You know, it's almost like, though we have learned it in mathematics, here we are trying to tell that A plus B equal to C plus D, but C plus D is not equal to A plus D. I mean, yes, Swami, you are my mother, you are my friend, you are my joy, but Swami, my mother is not you. How can it be? We feel Swami is our friend, but we are not ready to accept that our friend is Swami. Swami is friend, friend is Swami.
Really wonderful song, and I think at least for me, I have for the first time listening to this song with this kind of an understanding.
First time for me too, Prem. Really so beautiful. I just thought that the song would be good to play it, but you know, in light of the discussion, that is why I feel there is something very, very special about this satsang, Prem. You have experienced it, I have experienced it. We decide to speak something, and as we are speaking here, it is definitely Swami who moves the discussion along in one direction that we never thought about. It gets me to one doubt, you know. We have come to an agreement that the way to overcome body attachment is to see the unity in all, and the best, easiest way to see the unity of everyone is to treat everyone as God. And we also
kind
saw...
kind of a state of acceptance, you know. Whatever happens, you accept it.
But the state of acceptance, you know, is often considered as a weakness. I mean, suppose a boss does something to me. How do I know whether, I mean, it's again, I don't know, maybe I'm confused, but how do I know whether I'm accepting it because I'm spiritual, or whether I'm accepting it because I'm helpless? What can I do to him anyway?
Yeah, this problem always comes, you know, the concept of convenient philosophy. You are trying to philosophize your weakness, you know.
Correct. It's convenient to philosophize it.
But I think what the difference is, you know, when you have a choice to react, you don't react. When you have a choice to retaliate, you choose to think. That is what is the difference between a spiritual person and a person who is trying to take recourse in spirituality.
Okay.
So I think on any other occasion when you would have been angered or when you would have got flared up, you are ready to pause for a moment and think that why is this happening to me? What is the fault in my part in this whole situation and can I correct it?
Ah, so beautiful, Prem. That means, say suppose my boss irritated me or angered me and I'm upset. And right now, I don't have any choice of avenging myself. Okay. So after about 3 days, suppose my boss's superior comes and say his child and my child happen to go to the same school, so we get pally for some reason. And at that time, I have a chance to fill his ears with all my anger and irritation about my boss. And at that time, when I choose not to do it, that is spirituality. Because at that time, I have a choice. If I want, I can do it. It's not that I am helpless.
In fact, you know, there was this question which was put to Swami. You know, what is controlling anger? Because it's a very important thing, because that is something which we all face in worldly life, in daily life. Anger and people making you angry, and how do you react to situations that actually enrage you? So this person asked Swami, Swami, what is controlling anger? And Swami very clearly said there are two things, controlling anger and suppressing anger.
Okay.
Swami said, most of you, what you do is suppress anger. That you try not to express anger in that moment.
We control the expression of anger.
Expression of anger. Swami said, what will happen? It is like a pressure cooker. When you keep the pressure under check, at one point when the pressure cannot be put down, it bursts out and there's a loud whistle. That's what happens to you. It might have a vent in a different area. Like, you know, you get...
You go back home and shout at your wife.
You get banned by the boss, you come home and you shout. It happens to all of us. I mean, just because we are speaking about it, it doesn't mean that it doesn't happen to
us. No, we are just discussing whatever comes to our heart. So I feel that is a nice touchstone. Because if we are able to see God in all and give up ego, then it won't result in suppression of feelings, but in control of feelings.
And in fact, Swami went on to say, what is that control? And the way Swami explained it, it is actually something which all of us can relate to. Swami said, when you get angry, that anger lasts for a certain period of time. You know, an event has happened, the anger has arisen in you. And there is a period of time for which that anger is there, and then that anger subsides. And what happens when that anger subsides? You start to think.
Correct.
What actually happened? What was my mistake? Or, okay, there was no mistake of mine, but so what? That person might have had another problem. You tend to think of all the other angles which you wouldn't have thought when you are in that emotion, when you are under the control of anger. Right? So Swami said, controlling anger is to bring that thinking process between that event and that expression of anger.
Instead of after the expression of anger.
After the expression. And Swami said it's a very, very slow process. When you try to slowly increase that gap between the expression and that event and try to bring this thinking into that.
In fact, in one Trai session, Prem, I asked Swami, how does one control one's anger?
Okay.
And as you rightly said, Swami said that it starts with controlling of the expression, you know. Because that was the thing. He said, if at all you get angry, first thing is just hold up a mirror or go and look at yourself in the mirror. He said, like a monkey your face will be. It'll be so contorted and distorted that automatically you will feel like changing your face into something else. And I find this true. You know, actually it is happening in the reverse way. When I get angry, if I remember this, I go and look at the mirror. I don't want to look at the mirror because it embarrasses me. If at all I can hold on and continue to look at the mirror, I'm sure my anger will melt. Swami said, if that doesn't happen, go to the bathroom, open the tap, and in the pitch at which the water is falling, in that pitch try to sing a bhajan. And finally he said, even if that doesn't work, just go down, go out and run for 1 mile. After that you'll be so tired you won't have a chance to get angry. So though we feel that it should not be suppressed, controlling the expression of anger is indeed one of the baby steps that we have to take.
What I can, you know, get out of this beautiful thing, which Swami said, go and look at the mirror when you're angry. Swami is using that which is the cause for the anger itself to, you know, cure that anger. You know, if you look at it like that, see, anger comes out of ego.
Correct.
Suppose you hurt my pride, I get angry. Okay?
Yeah, it comes out of ego because, again, going by our definition, because I feel you are separate, I am separate.
And you are, you know, trespassing into my personal space, that you are trying to say that I am wrong.
Okay.
Correct. And that anger comes, that is because of attachment to your personality. So what Swami says, look at the mirror. Because you love your personality, you love yourself, you don't want to see that dirty face of yours.
Exactly.
So Swami is using that same ego which is giving rise to anger to tackle that anger.
That is
a beautiful thing actually.
That is the beauty of Swami, you know. In his teachings also, always I find that he uses our own weakness and converts them into our strengths. That is a beauty. I remember, in fact, reading a story about one master. He was a martial arts teacher. He was teaching a student who did not have the left hand.
Okay.
And the student always felt that, you know, I can never become a great martial artist because I don't have a left hand. I'm handicapped. So I can't win any championship, anything. But he kept prodding him, kept teaching him, and he kept encouraging him. This boy also learned, he fought and he had, sometimes he had some victories, but he was more on the losing side. Finally, the master told him to go and challenge the grand champion. He said, Master, are you crazy? I can't defeat normal people. What do you mean, challenge the champion? He said, you just do what I... Because he trusted his master, he did that. The master said, now I shall teach you one move. The master taught him one move. He said, you do this move, you will defeat him. He said, Master, are you sure? He said, you just trust me, have faith, go ahead and do it. So this boy, he goes and as the fight begins, he does that move. And to his greatest shock, the champion is pinned down and he wins. He is simply shocked. And he asks his master, he says, Master, how did this happen? He says, all the training that I wanted to you to go through was because you had to have that mentality and that physical body to fight. And he said, you know why you won that? That move that you learned, the only way to counter that move is to grab the left hand of the opponent who is doing that move.
Okay.
And so the master, through his guidance, had converted this disciple's greatest weakness into his greatest strength, which meant that any time he used this move, nobody could beat him.
And that is what Swami does to us all the time. When you come to him with his weakness, he just tags on to that.
Correct. Coming back to this, as you said, that mirror example is Swami using our own weakness to ensure that we defeat that weakness with the weakness itself.
And eventually the weakness gets removed.
Exactly. And as you rightly said before that, it is not enough. Though controlling the expression of anger is the first step, it is not a sufficient step. I remember one more anecdote, this time from the life of Sri Paramahamsa Yogananda.
Okay.
Sri Paramahamsa Yogananda was a disciple of Sri Yukteswar Giri. And during the course of his sadhana, one day as he sat in meditation, you know, a mosquito sat on his left hand and it began to suck blood. So Paramahamsa Yogananda got disturbed. Immediately that pain causes irritation. He was about to lift his right hand to kill the mosquito when he suddenly realized that, you know, he's not supposed to kill every being because everything is in fact divine. And so externally he didn't move even a bit because he got that and he controlled it. He just stopped the expression of it. But the next moment, his guru Yukteswar Giri, he tells him, why have you stopped? Go ahead, kill it. He is first of all amazed because his master knows
his mind.
Then he says, but master, we are not supposed to kill. He says, you have already killed it. The minute irritation and anger came in your mind, you killed it already. You're just controlling the expression of it. So that is where we go back to this example of the drama, you know. More important than the expression is what is inside. In his expression, Lord Krishna killed the demons. But what was the feeling inside? It was only to correct and not out of hatred or anger. That is what even the story of Shishupala shows.
Again, that concept of selflessness, that, you know, selflessness not in the sense of not wanting to gain anything from that, but not seeing the self at all, not seeing you as a self which is separate from the other,
You're just part of the whole.
In fact,
that is what happens even in the Shishupala episode. You know, Shishupala, for our listeners who are not aware, Shishupala is a so-called evil person and he hates Lord Krishna. He is jealous of Lord Krishna and so he starts abusing Lord Krishna. And Lord Krishna has given a promise to Shishupala's mother that come what may, till he hurls 100 abuses, I will not react to that. And so, in an open court, when Shishupala comes and starts hurling abuses at Lord Krishna, Krishna is close to everyone's heart. Everybody loves Krishna, so they are very irritated at this person. I often remember this example when, you know, when people come and criticize Swami.
Mm-hmm.
People don't know anything about Swami. There are some people who have no idea what Swami is, what good Swami has done. They don't even try to make an inquiry. They just grab some headline news, which is interested in all maligning itself, and they just come and tell, you know, Swami is like this, we hear, Swami is this, what is this? They criticize. At that time, I remember this example, because that is exactly what happened in the open court there.
Okay.
Krishna is being condemned and criticized by Shishupala, everybody is getting agitated, but Lord Krishna is calm. Nothing touches him. He is not showing a sign of anger, irritation, anything. He has given a promise to Shishupala's mother that I shall bear 100 insults of your son. The minute he crosses the 100th barrier, the 101st insult, Lord Krishna releases the Sudarshana Chakra, which goes and beheads Shishupala. Now see, again, it is not that Lord Krishna did it out of anger, because if it is anger, anger builds up. How can it be that 100 you are absolutely calm, peaceful, serene,
the 100th you blow
and the 101st you blow up, your eyes become red and you release the Sudarshana Chakra. It was the Lord playing out his part perfectly in the drama. And you know, further proof for this fact is because the minute Shishupala dies, is beheaded, everyone is jubilant. Everyone feels that that wretched dog deserves it. That is the kind of feeling going on in everyone because they are all so hurt. But Lord Krishna goes and merges the soul with himself, granting him, you know, moksha or liberation. That is true love. You know, Lord Krishna did not merge his soul because he, you know, he was attached to Shishupala. He did not kill him because he had irritation against Shishupala. And that, I feel, is what we have to learn about ego. Not that we have to change our expression. We have to change the intent behind the expression.
And in life, you know, even as you narrate this episode, many people wonder, you know, why we don't know our past. You know, I don't know whether you've thought of that any time. Many people come and, why don't we know all our past birth?
Correct.
You know, I think that knowledge or the absence of that knowledge is actually to our advantage. Because when we look at the world as a play and all are playing characters, we have to look at every person and maybe have that kind of doubt in our mind. Who knows what he is? Who knows who he is? I cannot judge him by what he is, you know, acting out right now.
And that is why you see all these divine people or God when he comes as avatar, Swami. Swami knows the past, present, future. I feel the past, present, future is hidden with a purpose. Say for example, we two are brought together in this life because there is some karma. There is some reaction that an action done in the past has to be faced. Suppose, say I have swindled you of some money. I mean, if you know that fact, will you be able to talk to me like this the way you are sitting and talking to me? So maybe the past is hidden from us with a reason because we are all highly egoistic. We attach ourselves to our own body and our own mind and we feel the other is a separate entity.
Then I think that will add a different dimension to this idea that the world is a play and each one is playing a character. Because even when you think that I'm playing a role and I should play it to perfection, there might be a sense of ego in that. And you might think that, you know, I'm playing the role better than him.
Exactly. That itself is ego again.
So I think all through, as much as possible, to bring in that thought of oneness is very, very important.
I think that is the most important, to remember that ego, anything that makes us feel separate, different from others and not one with the whole is ego. Imagine, for example, if the intestine feels, what is the stomach? It takes in all the juicy food, extracts all the energy out, and the fecal matter, the excreta, is what it pushes into me. I mean, karmically, the intestine is always having a problem with the stomach then. But if the intestine realizes that it's part of the whole, it changes the perspective entirely. It does its job of excretion perfectly. the stomach does its job of digestion perfectly, the whole being, the whole body goes on fine.
I think the perfect example of doing one's duty with the idea that of oneness behind, and I think even the person who is doing this will not know, I think it's the love of a mother.
You know? The love of a mother, not of a father?
I don't know. I mean, even though being a male by birth, I always feel that there is a difference between the love of a mother and love of a father.
Okay.
And that lies in this feeling of oneness. See, you look at a mother, you know, I don't know, what a beautiful feeling is that? A life form is actually being formed in you. When a mother is giving birth to a child, you are one and a life form is forming with you. And whether it is that 9 months of that pregnancy or after that, the mother always has the feeling that this is actually a part of me.
Beautiful, Prem, I get it now. So it is like, that is why the mother's love is eulogized, because a mother looks at a child as, this is a part of me.
Yeah.
While a father or a brother looks at, this is my son.
Mine.
This is a thing that belongs to me. I mean, the brother feels, this is my brother. This is my sister. This is my son. So it is an object that I own or I have.
But for a mother, it is an object which has actually come out of me.
Which is a part of
me. Which is actually always part of me. Maybe that is why a mother always looks at her children, not as her children.
Correct. As part of herself, her heart walking around. In fact, you know, I remember one small story I read. I do not remember the exact details. But it was something like, the boy stays back home and helps his mother.
Mm-hmm.
So he writes out a bill. He says, for closing the taps, these many pennies, for helping you keep the food in its place, these many pennies, for helping to sort out the clothes, these many pennies or whatever, for helping with the dishes. So he writes down the various things and gives a total bill of about $4. And then the mother smiles. The next day the boy finds $4 in his place along with a note which says, for bearing you in my womb with all your kicks and all your, you know, whatever you did
for nine months,
no charge. For changing your diapers, you know, when you were small, all the troubles, the so-called troubles that I went through, no charge. And the mother lists out all the different thing and says, there's no charge because I loved doing it. I enjoyed doing it. I'm grateful to you for having given me the chance to do it. And I feel the mother feels like that, as you rightly put it, because she feels that the child is a part of her. And that is why it is said that Swami has the love of a thousand mothers.
It's not that, you know, Swami can give you what thousand mothers can give you in the material sense. But his, you know, intention is that much more pure.
Exactly. Just like a mother feels for her child that this is a part of me, Swami is able to feel for the whole humanity that this is a part of me. This is a part of me. And that is why he is called the universal mother.
And I always used to wonder, no? Like, say a baby is, you know, suffering from, let us say, loose motions or something, you know. For any other person, it's a very ugly sight.
Exactly.
You know, would think twice, it's foul smelling and you'll have to clean up. But for a mother, the mother is not thinking about the foul smell, but it's thinking about, oh, if I don't clean up, what will happen to the
baby? The baby will be uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I feel that is what Swami always looks at as us. You know, he doesn't look at our problems or look at our flaws. He says, if I don't correct him, this child will not be safe.
And that is why, in order to correct us, he puts on anger, he puts on irritation, he puts on disappointment, the perfect actor that he is. I feel, once again, when it comes to overcoming ego, we just have to look to Swami and learn. It's almost time to complete our segment. Having spoken so much about the beauty of a mother's love, I think maybe we should end, we should complete today's segment, today's discussion, with a song on the mother.
Definitely. I mean, maybe before that, we could just quickly recap what we spoke about. We started with talking of ego.
And that came because of the Onam story, Vamana comes to crush the ego of Bali Chakravarti.
And then we went on to the understanding that ego cannot be confined only to the emotion of pride and possessiveness. Ego is also very, very subtle, and it can be anything which leads you to think that you are a separate entity.
So basically, ego is equal to false identity.
False identification.
If we have any false identification, that is ego. So what is the true identification?
The true identification is that you are a part of the whole.
Exactly.
And then we spoke of how we can bring this into practical life, how we can leverage this knowledge, and how it is important to always have this knowledge in the back of the mind in whatever we do. And that brought
us
to...
And how we should wear our emotions and not allow emotions to wear us.
Absolutely. And that brought us to how to anger management.
Correct.
How to deal with anger. And of course, what we spoke about just now, how Swami's mother is that of a thousand mothers' love. And why Swami says it's a thousand mothers' love and not a thousand
father's love.
Or a thousand brothers' or sisters' love.
Because if it is said a thousand father's love, there's a kind of, you know, again division. As you beautifully, that was a real nice point, Prem. Saying that a mother love is eulogized because a mother always feels the child is a part of her.
And I think the day when we can love Swami the way he loved us, is looking at us as just a part of himself.
Hmm.
I think that is when our love for Swami is going to be perfect.
Perfect.
And maybe till then, it would do us a lot of favor to look at Swami as our mother and thank him and love him for that motherly love that he has given us.
And I think, having come to this, let us take this opportunity to also express our gratitude, our love and thankfulness to all the mothers in the world.
Definitely, it would be absolutely apt to do
for
that.
For their selflessness and for being model examples from which we can learn how to even overcome our ego.
And truly, in this very relationship of a mother has taught us a better understanding of what Swami's love is.
Exactly.
And so, dear listeners, we really hope that you've enjoyed this week's Afternoon Satsang. And as always, it was me, Prem, from Team Radio Sai.
And Arvind from Team Radio Sai. And we offer this at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan with all humility. Because, dear listeners, there is a disclaimer. This is as just a discussion, a satsang, where each of us is sharing and pouring our hearts out. So it is not that this is the perfect, what we are speaking is perfect and what we are speaking is the Vedic truth.
And even as we speak, our understanding is growing.
So it is benefiting, it is helpful, and hope it has been helpful to you too. All your thoughts, your suggestions, your ideas and what you feel about this topic.
And if you have any topic which you would like us to discuss, of course.
All those are welcome. Please mail us at listener@radiosai.org. listener@radiosai.org, because it will contribute tremendously to this satsang. Because the more, the merrier. So all your thoughts about what we have discussed on ego, whatever you feel, please do share it with us. We are eagerly awaiting your letters.
Thank you, dear listeners, for being with us. And continue to be with Radio Sai, because we're going to play a beautiful song for you. This is Prem and Arvind offering our most loving salutations at the lotus feet of our most beloved Mother Sai. And a wonderful song on Swami, our Mother, coming your way.
Ma, oh Ma, Ma Sai Ma. दिल यही कहता है माँ संग रहे हरदम यहाँ दिल यही कहता है माँ संग रहे हरदम यहाँ तेरे प्यार में पलकर मारे पूरी हुई तमन्नाएं सारे तेरे प्यार में पलकर हमारे पूरी हुई तमन्नाएं सारी माँ ओ माँ माँ साई माँ माँ ओ माँ माँ साई माँ तुम्हीं से हमने जीवन पाया तुमने हमको जीना सिखाया तुम्हीं से हमने जीवन पाया तुमने हमको जीना सिखाया देकर हमको सुख की छाया दुख का तूने भार उठाया माँ ओ माँ माँ जिंदगी भर नहीं भूलेंगे इन बीते दिनों को माँ ओ माँ जिंदगी भर नहीं भूलेंगे इन बीते दिनों को माँ ओ माँ जिंदगी भर नहीं भूलेंगे प्यार में तेरे खो जाएंगे माँ ओ माँ ओ माँ चाहे मिट जाए चांद सितारे हम सदा रहेंगे तुम्हारे चाहे मिट जाए चांद सितारे हम सदा रहेंगे तुम्हारे दिल यही कहता है माँ संग रहे हरदम
Sai Ram. You just heard an episode of our radio series, Afternoon Satsang. This is a live discussion between Radio Sai's Prem and Arvind on different spiritual topics. And today's episode was first featured as part of Radio Sai's First Day Live at 12:30 PM on 30th August 2012. You can mail us your comments and feedback to listener@radiosai.org. Sai Ram.